Hello everyone, welcome to Insights Alley. In this series about startup basics, we will try to understand and learn from insights shared by various phenomenal people around startups, product, growth, sales, strategy, and everything in between. My name is Arun Verma, and let's get started. In today's episode, we will be going back to the best advice and nuggets from all of our Insights Alley episodes in 2018. So here's the part three of that and the last of it.
So how to actually design an excellent pricing page in terms of overall strategy and then also structure, copy, UI elements, etc. for the pricing page. Any key learnings, tip tactics from all the pricing page tear downs that you've been doing for so many companies?
Yeah, totally. So the big thing to keep in mind here is I am definitely not a designer.
Okay.
I don't play one on TV. It's not my expertise. And so it is one of those things to kind of think about just in terms of my advice here. So most of my advice is probably going to be around experience and kind of what we've seen work really well.
Right.
So I think in terms of experience, it goes back to that persona, which we talked about a while ago. And you want to make sure that when a persona comes to your page, and let's say you're targeting three different types of people, small companies, big companies, and medium companies, and let's make it more specific, small sales teams, medium sales teams, large sales teams.
Right.
When that person comes to that page, there shouldn't be a lot of confusion around which page they should be going to, or excuse me, which plan that they belong to. So you want to make sure the copy, the names of your pricing plans, all of those different things, you want to make sure line up to basically those folks going to the right page or going to the right plan, I should say. In addition to that, you also want to make sure that your particular customers have very little confusion around what in God's name that they're purchasing. There's a lot of pricing pages that I go to and I'm just like, I have no idea what they're selling to me. I know it has a vague, concept of X, Y, Z, but it's not something that I'm really, really super clear on. And so that's another thing to kind of think through. I don't think a lot of people do think through those types of things. And then around design, if you continue to add more complexity, you probably should just reduce that complexity and then have a sales process. If you can't do that, then you definitely need to rethink who you're targeting and what you're basically selling to them, because that complexity can obviously make it difficult. And that's where it comes back to that particular customer.
Right. About different plans and different buyer persona, how should founders think around, okay, what should be a self-serve entirely and in what places should we start and giving those leads to the sales team with a contact sales button? How should we think around this?
Yeah, I think this comes down to a lot of unit economic conversations.
Okay.
So understanding, so for example, if it's a $50 a month customer, it's hard to have a business unless you have just insane velocity of, customers coming in or prospects coming in. It's hard to imagine staffing that with a salesperson. Even a very inexpensive salesperson, it's something that's really, really tough. And so normally what you want to find is where is that level through which you can basically set things up in order to properly have good unit economics when it comes to acquiring customers. Now, I think that depending on who you ask, that might be a $500 a month minimum. That could be a $1,000 a month minimum. But in some cases, it comes down to $50 a month because there's a ton of leads coming through and your expectation might be to sell, 100 of those deals in a particular month. So it really comes down to the unit economics. And I think that if you're finding you can't sell something for 50 bucks a month or less or a little bit more without a salesperson and you don't have that velocity, then there's probably something wrong and you should explore what's going on there.
Let's say now we have started with a conversation with a person or even met the person. Now, how should an entrepreneur nurture and grow that relationship to make it long lasting? What are your views on that?
Okay, so you started a relationship and you want to grow it?
Exactly.
And is there a type of person or it doesn't matter?
In business and startup context also only. So let's say I am working on a social media app. So I reach out to, let's say, some VP of product in Instagram. So that would be a very good person to connect to, right? So now I've started a conversation to a VP of, let's say, Instagram, a VP of product, and I'm making a social media app. So how should I try to grow and nurture that relationship?
Okay. Have you ever connected with them in a one-to-one?
No, I'm just taking it in a hypothetical manner. So,
okay. So I think that the example that I shared earlier with the Disney person is a sort of a perfect example of that. That things start. So if you set up identities across the key places where your core prospects have conversations, right? And for me, it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Crunchbase, AngelList, et cetera, right? And you start to share content across those places, then people are going to bite, right? And that's what happened with you, with this person, is they bit. How do you then take that bite and then turn it into something more? Well, you need to first off be able to determine which bites are best, right? Because if you're fishing in the ocean and you throw out a big net, you can't just bring everything into the boat. You need to bring in the ones that are going to give you the most value, and maybe the ones that you could add the most value to,
right.
So that you can then determine if this is something that you would want to focus your attention and energy on. And in the process of that, you want to create enough touch points to take conversation from that softer place. And for me, the softer places are Twitter and Instagram, to a more firm place, which would be possibly a LinkedIn connection and or a actual calendar connection, because ultimately you need to take these digital soft touches into one-to-one conversations.
Makes sense.
And before you do the one-to-one conversation, you need to do your homework. You need to know who they are and what the business is about, because it's your job to add value. We're on this planet to help other people grow. And so for you to then take that connection and grow it into something permanent, you need to find a way to add value. You may learn that by just nimbling them and their company, but you're going to learn most by asking some simple questions and shutting up and letting people talk. And if you let somebody talk to tell you their story, not only will you learn about ways to add value to them, but they'll love you. Because people love to be seen and heard. It is the most basic need that we all have, which is why we spend so much time posting crap in our social apps so that people then plus one, like, comment, and engage with us. Because we're all starving. And if you could find ways to feed people's souls, they'll love you. But most importantly, you need to truly add value. That's the follow-up and follow-through. And the best way to take that relationship and deepen it further is to add value. And the simplest way to add value is to do an intro. Everybody needs somebody. And if you could figure out which somebody's in your network that you can help that person with, that's a natural way to add value. And the other way to add value is to figure out what that person's passion, plan, and purpose in life and find ways to blow wind in their sails. And that might be, you know, you lending a hand in some way or another. And what I like to do with other influencers is I give them my soapbox and give them the ability to tell their story on my platform, because we have hundreds of thousands of users. And the benefit to people to, you know, get access to that. And so either way, if you want to deepen relationships, you need to take the soft connections into firm connections, learn more about people, find ways to add value, and then basically rinse and repeat. You have to just continue to do that, because people will lose touch over time, and you need to basically periodically go and reconnect to recharge the relationship.
Makes sense. What if the person is like very senior or at very higher level in terms of learning and experience? How can a person and an entrepreneur be of value to that person? I'm curious to know, because I agree with your example that introductions or providing some sort of value is the best way. I remember once you mentioned in the podcast, shout out to the SaaS podcast, the intent of any relationship should be desire to serve the other person and help them grow. Such a great thought. So for example, how as a person, Arun as a person, can be of value to you, John? I'm curious to know, how should I think around this and be of value to you?
Well, I think that you started with your outreach email by simply taking the time to truly listen to my words.
Right.
And to share with me the ones that vibrated with you, right, that inspired you. And so I was leaving my doctor's office the other day. And in America, the doctors have like 5 or 10 rooms, and they put the patients in and they go back and forth between the rooms, right, to maximize their engagement. So I was walking out of my room and I bumped into this little old man. Hmm. And I looked down at him and I said, "Fuck, you're Mick Jagger."
Oh, okay.
And sorry about the F word there. So, but I was just sharing my expression, right? My shock, right?
I mean,
you don't expect to see Mick Jagger every day.
Right.
And he was really short and really old.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, why does this guy get up on stage 100 times a year? He's kind of old to do that. And he certainly doesn't need the money.
Right.
And I think that he does what he does because he loves the dance with the people. He loves the feedback. He loves to move people.
Right.
And so even though I may have many more years of experience or success than you do, Arun, that you connected with me by sharing how I moved you, which was a pat on my back to let me know that the work that I do is valuable to others. And so you don't have to worry about being too small or insignificant to be able to reach out to whomever. Because whomever you reach out to has needs as well.
Right.
And you can find ways to serve those needs.
I was working on my own startup. It was a B2B SaaS product for restaurants, for table management, booking management. So initially, what we did was, we'll just go to these restaurant managers and decision makers and just show them a very good visual slide and tech kind of that how would the product would work exactly. And also especially like very hone in on to the exact benefits of the product, that value proposition of the product. So that was my initial sales strategy, just to try to gauge their interest. Because I have read like for consumer tech products, you just make landing pages and pitch and benefits of the product and just collect emails. So that was my version for doing this for these restaurant managers. But it failed absolutely. So because they were asking, just show me something. Show me the product, how it looks, how it feels in my laptop. I can't decide shit if I don't see anything. So then what we did was, okay, we made made wireframes on Marvel app. And also just put in the logo of the customers and just some fake bookings with fake names also. And then we showed them, then we were just kind of, okay, we were getting some interest. But one thing that we did wrong, we did not ask for money right up front. We just want, oh, okay, would you be interested in that? Just trying to gauge their interest and just getting feedback. From this example, I wanted to ask, look, how should entrepreneurs make that decision? Okay, should we make the product or some sort of wireframes and all, then showcase and try to sell them? What should be the strategy?
It depends. You know, I don't think that there is one way that fits every model. It also depends on your strength. It depends on your buyer, okay, right? The question really is, our customer, what does that customer need to see? What does that customer, how does that customer think? What does that customer need in order to be able to give us the best kind of feedback and insights and information, right? So if I sell to, let's say I sold a tool to designers,
right?
Making the presentation really visual is probably important because visual, you know, is the language that they speak, right?
Makes
and then potentially not just asking them to talk to me about things, but maybe give them a more visual outlet to give feedback, right? So doing wireframe brainstorming sessions or bringing, you know, a piece of paper, showing them, you know, some wireframes that are printed, but then like scribbling with them and telling them, how would you change this? What about this is good? What about this is bad? And let them express themselves in a way that they feel comfortable and strong in. Now, if I'm selling to, you know, tax accountants,
right?
Using the same approach might not be a good idea because they're just not visual people. They don't care that much, or that doesn't communicate that much. So for them, it might be a lot more about the numbers and the metrics and whatever else, right? So I think you need to just ask yourself, who is my customer and how do they like to purchase and how do they like to communicate and be communicated to? What's the language, the native language that they like to talk to? And part of the language could be that they like to read a lot of stuff, or that they like to visualize, or that they like to brainstorm, or that they, whatever it is, right?
Right.
And then the other side is yourself, right? You need to ask yourself, what are our strengths, right? What are some unique skills that we have that we can use in the early days? So if you have a bunch of people, like if you have somebody like me, right? I am a very experienced salesperson, right? A sales entrepreneur. Right. So I will use my communication, my people skills to set up meetings, to sit down, to build relationships, to talk to people, look them in the eye, to gauge their feedback, their body language, their tonality, to follow up with them, to get a deal done or get some money from them as validation. That's going to be my tools. If you told me, Stelly, the best way to validate is you need to do really beautiful wireframes, and now I have to make these wireframes, now you've slowed me down a lot. Right now I'm going to be a really shitty version. It's going to take me way too long. I'm not going to do that good of a job. I'm not going to enjoy that. When I go out, when people give me feedback, it's going to take me forever to actually update or implement that feedback. So now, you know, because this doesn't fit my skill, I've used a way to validate my idea that just makes me slower and worse off. So I would always start with the customer and who they are, what they need, and then look into the team and go, what are our strengths? What's something we can do really well? What's our experience? What is something we're excited about? And I would try to match the founding team and its internal skills with the market and customer we're going after. And that should determine how you go about it.
Ideal customer profile, ICP, and one thing I think you feel very passionate about is non-ICP. That would be non-ideal customer profile.
Yes.
First of all, would you like to tell us more? What do you mean by ICP and non-ICP, and the nuances around that? When should company think around that? Why is it important?
Yeah, so ICP, ideal customer profile, is an idea that's been around for a long time in marketing and sales, which just means define who is your customer, right? And do it as specifically and as definitively as possible. And being broad is your enemy. So, you know, the more focused it is, the better. You can't just be saying, oh, well, anybody alive on this planet right now is my ideal customer profile, right? That is a really shitty ideal customer profile, because it doesn't tell me who to go and look for. It doesn't tell me how to do marketing and selling. I don't know. Everybody's too broad, right? So you want to be specific. There's a lot of literature. There's a lot of blogging. There's a lot of content around in many, many companies on how to define your ideal customer profile, how to do this. There's a lot of good stuff out there online. I find that a lot of times, most companies, they are way too broad with how they define who they want to go after. Hmm. And so I have coined as a countermeasure, don't just say who you want to sell to, define who you're not going to sell to, who is your non-ideal customer, who is somebody who shouldn't purchase your product, right? Hmm. So if I, if I've created a medication specifically for men, with heart diseases, then I should say that children that want to purchase this medicine should not be able to purchase it, right? Because it's going to be harmful for them. And I can't just take a lazy approach and go, well, anybody who has money can buy my product, right? I don't care if it's children or not. They went to my website, they said, buy this product, and they bought it. That's not a good idea. In medicine, we understand it because it can have, you know, really fatal, you know, consequences, and it's regulated by the government. Right. And in B2B, same thing. Just because you have a product, it shouldn't be purchased by everybody, right, who wants to purchase it. You should think about who are people that cannot get value from my product, so they should not buy. And the reason why you should define that prior is that if you don't, as most startups, you're going to be really desperate at times for hitting revenue goals, for hitting certain milestones, for getting numbers up for your next investor meeting or for whatever the hell you're trying to do. And so when you're desperate and you need to hit your numbers and there's a bunch of children with money that want to buy the medicine, you're going to come up with some bullshit story on why they should buy it, right? You're going to be like, it's not that bad. Maybe they're just going to buy it, not look at it. Maybe they're not going to use it. Maybe they're buying it for their dads. I don't know. But you're going to start bullshitting yourself and others. Maybe we should do it. So a lot, and then you're going to make really, really fatal mistakes. So in startup speak, that means you are building a solution for small restaurants. You are a team of four people that have restaurant experience. you're going out, you're trying to get restaurants to purchase your software, and then for whatever random reason, some VP at some Fortune 500 corporation found your solution and thinks they could use this too internally for their catering services or whatever the hell, right? So they ping you and they go, well, I am, you know, working at IBM and I think maybe we should also use this. That's a terrible idea, right? It's a terrible idea for you to go down that road. Okay. To go, well, I didn't go after IBM. IBM came to us. Maybe we should sell to IBM. Maybe we could make a lot of money. Right now, we need to hit our numbers. And because you didn't define before that our solution is not for enterprise clients, our team is not experienced in enterprise clients, we don't have the financing to go after enterprise clients. So if enterprise clients come to us, we're going to say no. Yeah, we're going to say no to them. Because you didn't define them as non-ideal customers, you're going to just be tempted to say yes. And then what's going to most likely happen is you're going to start having these conversations with them, more and more sales meetings, more and more legal meetings. More. It's going to be the thing that you thought would take easy 4 weeks and a lot of money took you now 18 months and has totally distracted you. And you're not able to deliver the solution they need with their security concerns and legal concerns and all that because you didn't build something for enterprise. You built something for restaurants. And a lot of startups get distracted easily because they didn't define who their non-ideal customer is. So you absolutely have to do that.
Is this ICP and non-ICP just based on that type of segmentation? Okay, we'll sell to enterprise, small SMBs, SMEs, or startups, or just individual people. Is it that kind of segmentation only, or there is something more to it also?
It can be all kinds of segmentation. So it could be size of corporation or type of corporation or organization. It could be a country, right? Oh, a region.
Yeah, one,
hey, we cannot sell to companies in Europe because they need GDPR compliant legal shit, and we are not ready for that, right?
Right.
Or it could be, you know, it could have to do with the type of technology stack that the customer is. So it's like we want to sell to enterprise clients that also use, you know, Microsoft or open source Linux, or that also use this because they need to use this other piece of technology to make sense to use our piece of technology. Or it could be a cultural thing. We are selling software for employee happiness. So we can only sell to companies that truly care about company culture and employee happiness. So the best way to identify for that is for them to have an HR department that has a head of happiness or culture, or whatever the hell it is, right?
Right.
It can be many, many ways, but you have to segment. You have to have segmentation criteria for what is a good customer and what isn't.
Right. And I think startups should think of ICP and non-ICP from very start because the whole product is highly influenced by this decision. So makes sense. What is churn? And I mean, as an overall concept and then exact numeric metric also, because since it's a very important thing for success, failure of your SaaS business, right? Excited to know your thoughts.
Yeah, so churn is sort of like one of the unpleasant parts about running a subscription business. every company has some of it once they, you know, get a certain volume of customers. And what churn is? I mean, churn is just another word for like subscription cancellation. What people usually talk about is the churn rate, which is the rate at which customers are canceling. Like if you have 100 customers and one of them cancels, then in a given month, then your churn rate is 1% for that month because you lost one of your customers.
What different type of churn could be there? So like one would be way to look at is customer churn. Then it could be MRR, dollar churn, anything else?
Exactly. Yeah. Like you have customer churn, also called logo churn. And that's just number of subscribers and one of them cancels. You lost 1% of your revenue. There's two types of revenue churn that's interesting.
Right.
One is net revenue churn or net MRR churn. And that is basically, it's the sort of the sum of all the churn and the downgrades in revenue. So it's the sum of the MRR that you lost in a given month minus the sum of all of the MRR from the upgrades. So it's offset for the upgrades. So say you have a MRR of $100,000. And you lost, $10,000 in revenue. So you lost 10% of your revenue in a given month. But the customers you kept also upgraded $5,000. So that offsets it. You net it out. So then your actual churn, your net MRR churn rate was only 5%, not 10%. And say you had $10,000 of upgrades from them, and then you have a net MRR churn rate of 0%. Or you can even have negative net churn, which is really awesome because even if you're losing customers, your revenue is still growing, something like that. Maybe it doesn't work if the numbers are 10%, because eventually you'll run out of customers to upsell to. But like the idea there being like, you know, you might lose, you know, say you got $100,000 in revenue and you lose $1,000 in revenue due to churn, but you upsell your existing customers, the customers that you retain happen to be paying $2,000 more across the board. Like maybe it's like, you know, a few of them upgraded by $10 here and there, and it added up to $2,000 in MRR, and therefore your net MRR churn rate is actually minus 1%, because you had a 1% upsell on your existing customer base. So that's fine, but it also it's fine for knowing how that you have a healthy business, right? Like, you know, you've almost kind of created a business that's not as, you know, susceptible to the damaging effects of churn as another business might be. But it doesn't really help you solve it. It kind of hides the underlying problem, which is that, you know, $1,000, 1% of the customer base is actually canceling. So there's another metric called gross MRR churn rate, which basically just takes the sum of all the churn and all the downgrades in revenue and divides it by the MRR at the start of the period.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, if you're, it would give you a 1% revenue churn or whatever. It doesn't offset it for the upgrades. And therefore, you can say, okay, that's the real churn. That's actually
okay,
what's churn.
Understood. But I think this concept of negative churn kind of makes sense. And SaaS business should be striving for that, because it's like your expansion revenue is offsetting the churn that you're having, right?
Oh, it's great. And like when you tell people your churn rate, like just tell them that number, like, because it's going to sound real. And especially if you're pitching for investment and VCs, absolutely show your net MRR churn rate, because it's going to be way better. And sometimes if it's negative, you should show it off. But internally, when you're talking with your team, your management team,
right,
and you actually want to solve the problems that your company has, then definitely look at the gross churn number, because that's where the actual problems lie, right?
Let's talk about organized and documented learning. So first of all, what do you record after you have completed an experiment? What do you exactly record? And also the importance of documentation in the testing process, whether it's a failed experiment or a success experiment or somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm. So when I think about this, I like to think about if I was, you know, to think about the hit by a bus theory, and okay, I, you know, was a race tomorrow from the organization, would the next person that came along have what they need to be successful? And in my opinion, that comes down to knowing what's been tested in the past. And this has been really useful for us, actually. I remember my first week at Growth Hackers, I just went into the software and looked at everything that had been tested previously, and it took me like 3 days to get through everything. But then at that first growth meeting, I had a much better idea of what had been tested in the past and what recommendation would actually make sense. So in terms of what to record, you know, I think if you have any creative, it's important to show what was actually implemented. So whether that's screenshots of, you know, the website or a PDF of the email that you sent, you know, whatever it is, just giving that end result, putting that into record somewhere. And then qualitative feedback from customers is really important. Obviously, if the test won or didn't win, and the results as it compares to the hypothesis. And then anything else that comes to mind is like secondary, but I think also great to include. So, you know, maybe the website broke at that point when you launched it, or whatever, you know, just whatever you can capture, keep it, you know, keep it organized, but it whatever you can capture, I think will be helpful for the next person coming in or anybody that wants to get involved in that growth process.
Yeah, I've actually seen many startups, like, they don't document. So I kind of understand like this importance of documented learning, even not in just growth, even in let's say product decisions that you make and something you have to kill off. So that documentation process, indeed, very important.
Well, Well, I'll tell you what, you know what, documentation is not sexy. So
yeah, exactly.
it is something that requires discipline. And exactly. I think when you do have a weekly meeting or something like that, or you have someone that is actually making sure ideas get put into, you know, the analyzed zone, then your chances of actually getting that done, if they're being held accountable, are much higher. But that takes a leader that finds the importance of that, and not every leader does. And if you don't have that as one of your, you know, things that you think needs to be done, well, it's probably time to reconsider that. But understand, it's not going to be that easy, because it is something that is reactionary most times. Right. It's, oh, well, what, how did that test perform? And then nobody knows the answer. Oh, did John document it? No, John didn't document it. Oh, okay. You know, like, yeah, it's usually it's too late.
And the reason given is that we have to move fast. So why just waste your time in documentation? We can be moving much more faster. But yeah, I get your point. It's very important. That's it, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Show notes would be available in the link below, or you can just go to insightsalley.com/notes. Please rate, review, subscribe in whichever app you are listening to this episode. And most importantly, give feedback in comments, reviews, or you can just email me at arun@insightsalley.com. You can also follow and connect with me on Instagram, Twitter, etc. My handle everywhere is arun11192. And remember, always be learning. Bye.